From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A lone wolf struck again at a soft target. The Orlando killer had no known organizational ties to ISIS, though he had been investigated by the FBI. In the years since 9/11, attacks by a lone wolf keep happening. They've become the weapon of choice for ISIS in the West. How do you stop such an insidious threat? This hour on Point, global safety and the lone wolf. You can join us on air or online. Do you understand the challenge for the FBI tracking down these needles in the national haystack? Does the U.S. have the best strategy to defeat homegrown radicals? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me first now from Orlando is Jamie Yucas. She's a correspondent for CBS News. Jamie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
Well, I'm okay. Investigators are scrutinizing the second wife of the Orlando killer about what she knew about the massacre at the nightclub. What are they finding?
You know, the wife of the gunman, who you just indicated, Noreen Solomon, who attacked a gay Orlando nightclub, killing at least 49 people and injuring dozens of others, she told authorities that she tried to stop her husband from committing the attack. She told authorities that she went with her husband, Omar Mateen, to Pulse nightclub on at least one prior occasion. We do know as well from law enforcement sources that Mateen was in the general area of that Pulse nightclub for several hours before he went into the club and launched his attack early Sunday morning. We had heard from witnesses on scene as well that at one point in time, it seemed Mateen had gone into the nightclub and was seen drinking and partying and then left at one point and came back. Solomon, the wife, has been interviewed by the FBI. She's been administered a polygraph test. And according to investigators, she has been cooperating, but she could face possible criminal charges at this point because there's no evidence that she ever called police to warn them that she believed Mateen was planning an attack. She told the FBI that her husband had become radicalized in the last year. Family members have said that the pair did have a young son, about 3 years old. The other interesting point here from law enforcement is that they were able to confirm that Mateen and his wife had both visited Disney World at least twice this year, once in April and again this month. The visits were likely confirmed by Disney's vast network of security cameras. The April trip, it turned out, was a family outing. But investigators do believe that Mateen was indeed casing Disney World and not there to have, you know, a so-called good time with his family. Investigators are now trying to see who Mateen was in contact with and who may have had some knowledge of his plan.
Well, didn't she also join him on one or more visits to a Florida gun store where he bought weapons and ammunition?
That is one. We have heard that from law enforcement sources as well, that she did go with him. She apparently, you know, did try to talk him out of doing this, that she knew of his plans to potentially attack. And she had been at the club with him on at least one occasion, according to law enforcement.
And so what's her background?
Her background is, you know, she's a wife, she's a mother, she's somebody that's cooperating with police at this point. I don't have specifics at this point in time as to, you know, some of the intricate details of their family network, but it appears on Blackboard messages that there were some books dedicated to Islam with doctorates in the apartment where Mateen lived with his wife. Now, it's unclear if she also participated in that, but the report describes Blackboard messages in the kitchen, those like Blackboards that all of us have in our kitchens usually to outline details of what we're going to go about our day, that there was an appointment for their three-year-old son's school, a note with an Arabic phrase praising God. In the living room, there was a document living in the items that investigators had removed as well, because investigators have been inside the apartment that the two shared. But other than that, at this point in time, we just know that that they were a couple, they shared a three-year-old child, and they did live together, and that she had knowledge of this attack.
And the shooter, during the attack, we know he called 911, but now we're learning that he also called a local TV station.
Yes, he did, as a matter of fact. He called a local affiliate here and said some of the same things that he said to law enforcement that have been documented on a number of occasions by witnesses who were inside the bathroom with him for several hours. It was up to 3 hours those hostages were in the bathroom with him, where he told the local television station that he had pledged his allegiance to ISIS, and that he, as a matter of fact, started saying that that this act was for the Islamic State specifically. He started speaking in Arabic, and he had said that America should stop bombing his country. Now, he was born here in the United States, so it's unclear what country specifically he was talking about.
Jamie Yucas, correspondent for CBS News. Jamie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joining me now from Washington is Peter Bergen. He is vice president at New America and national security analyst for CNN. He's also author of the recent book, United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Peter Bergen, always nice to have you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Jane.
So the lone wolf at a soft target. You've written about the strategy of a leaderless jihad. Is that now the dominant strategy that ISIS is using to attack the West?
Well, I think both. I mean, we saw in Paris where seven, shooters on the ground in multiple targets in Paris killed 130 people. Well, all of them had been trained by ISIS in Syria. So that's one approach. And then we saw just this week the attack in Orlando that killed 49 people that was inspired by ISIS. And then the following day on Monday, we saw an ISIS-inspired militant kill a French police official and his partner in front of their three-year-old boy and basically broadcast live on Facebook as he was perpetrating his crime.
You've compiled, Peter Bergen, a database, actually, of people in the United States who've been charged with a jihadist crime. What's the profile of that one category, that specific category, the lone wolf, self-radicalized attacker? And does the Orlando shooter fit that profile?
Well, myself and my research team at New America, the think tank where I work, we looked at every jihadist terrorism case since 9/11, of which there are more than 300, and some of them are relatively trivial, sending small sums of money to an overseas terrorist organization, and some of them are very serious, murder, conspiracy to murder, etc. And the profile that emerges is not the young hothead of popular imagination, average age 28, a third are married, a third have kids. They are not career criminals. Very few of them have been to jail. Their rate of incarceration is similar to the rest of the American male population, around 10%. They don't have high incidences of mental illnesses. In fact, they seem to be more sane than the general population. They are, in some, ordinary Americans. And unfortunately, whether it's in San Bernardino, California, where the married couple who had a kid and he had a solid middle-class job, fit this profile almost perfectly. They were both college graduates. They killed 14 people at a Christmas holiday party. Similarly with Omar Mateen. He was married twice. He had a child. He maintained a steady job. He was living, to all intents and purposes, what looked on the surface like a totally ordinary American life. And yet at the same time, he seemed to be struggling with a number of inner demons and that we don't yet know. And we may never know, by the way, because when you get to the nature, somebody who kills 49 strangers, innocent civilians, I mean, we can come up with some answers, attempt to answer the question, the big question, why? But eventually you begin to hit a brick wall, because what did this achieve? It just ruined the lives of the 49 families. There are dozens of people also wounded. Did this change American foreign policy? Did this really do anything? Of course not.
So unlike al-Qaeda, which required and is requiring months of training and planning, the Islamic State has encouraged anyone really to take up arms in its name. Here, speaking in May, is ISIS spokesman Abu Muhammad al-Adnani urging ISIS supporters to carry out killings abroad during the holy month of Ramadan. He said that no attack was too small and specifically named the U.S. as a target. And this is the translation to the soldiers of the Islamic State and its supporters in Europe and America. If the tyrants have closed in your faces the door of migration, then open the door of jihad and make their act a source of pain for them. The smallest action you do in the heart of their land is dearer to us than the largest action by us and more effective and more damaging to them. End quote. Peter Bergen, what about this? Don't come to the Middle East, just stay where you are.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, for law enforcement and the intelligence community, we don't want people going for training in Syria, obviously. Yet at the same time, if we prevent people from going, or if they conclude that it's too difficult, and they're encouraged by ISIS to just do something in their own countries, we have what we saw unfold in Orlando, or what we saw unfold in Paris on Monday, just outside Paris, where the ISIS militant killed the French police official and his partner. So, that's neither is a great outcome. But at the end of the day, it is more important, actually, I think, for us to, the reason that the Paris attackers were so successful, unfortunately, was the training. I mean, they killed 130 people. The reason, typically lone wolves, like we saw in Orlando, there's a kind of limit to their capacity. Now, he was able to kill a lot of people because he had an AR-15 military-style assault rifle, which he bought perfectly legally in this country because of our very permissive gun laws. And also he selected a target which he knew from having cased it millions of times, that on a Sunday night at 2 a.m., that was going to be the peak moment in terms of having the most people there in an enclosed space. And he killed a lot of people, unfortunately. But lone wolves are, generally speaking, not as deadly as people who've trained overseas. So, the government, the U.S. government and other Western governments, are rightly very concerned about people going overseas and getting training and coming back.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. After the shooting in Orlando, we're talking about the threat of a lone wolf attacks on soft targets, and you can join the conversation. In the age of the lone wolf, is there any place that's safe? Do we just live our lives and hope for the best? Be more vigilant. When we see something, say something. Yesterday in Washington, President Obama talked about the difficulty facing U.S. law enforcement as they try to prevent lone wolf attacks from being carried out.
These lone actors or small cells of terrorists are very hard to detect and very hard to prevent. But across our government, at every level, federal, state, and local, military and civilian, we are doing everything in our power to stop these kinds of attacks.
From Washington today, Peter Bergen is with me. He's vice president at New America and author of United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Peter, we've written that since 9/11, every lethal jihadist terrorist attack in this country has been carried out by an American citizen or legal resident, which might surprise a lot of people as it seems to contradict the narrative about terrorism that we often hear, especially on the campaign trail, Peter.
Indeed. And, Donald Trump on Monday, a day after the Orlando tragedy, came out with a speech in New Hampshire, billed as a major terrorism speech. It was very light on detail, which doesn't surprise anybody who's following him. But his big idea is to ban immigration from quite a number of Muslim countries in an effort to stop terrorism. Well, of course, this would be completely pointless because the people who are doing these attacks are not refugees or recent immigrants, they're American citizens. After all, Omar Mateen, who carried out the attack in Orlando, was born in Queens in New York City, which makes him, Donald Trump was born in Queens in New York City as well. And in his speech on Monday, Donald Trump referred to Omar Mateen as an Afghan. Well, he's not an Afghan, he's an American citizen. He's as American as Donald Trump is. So the idea that somehow banning or temporarily banning immigration from particular Muslim countries would address this issue is basically completely ludicrous.
Peter Bergen, let me bring another voice into the conversation here. Joining me from Charleston, South Carolina is Michael S. Smith, co-founder of the security firm Kronos Advisory. He also serves as a counterterrorism advisor to Congress. Mike Smith, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane.
So let me play some sound here. In a Washington press conference on Monday, FBI Director James Comey spoke about the Orlando mass shooting. He said that the FBI has reviewed their work in the case of shooter Omar Mateen and that so far they have not identified anything that FBI agents should have done differently in their investigation.
Our work is very challenging. We are looking for needles in a nationwide haystack. But we're also called upon to figure out which pieces of hay might someday become needles. That is hard work. If we can find a way to do that better, we will.
So, Mike Smith, The FBI interviewed the Orlando killer twice, concluded he didn't represent an immediate threat. So when law enforcement has volumes of people like him in the United States who've expressed some interest in radicalism, how do you possibly defend against this insidious threat, this lone wolf threat?
It's quite difficult. And I can tell you that it's not uncommon for FBI to publicly say that they did nothing in the way of, let's say, deficiencies in their process of examining somebody. That was the case after Fort Hood. They also emphasized that nothing could have been done to better manage the assessment of threats posed by one of the brothers who was responsible for the Boston Marathon attack, despite the fact that a foreign intelligence service had said that this is somebody who is planning on traveling abroad to join a foreign terrorist organization and execute acts of terrorism. So there are an awful lot of needles out there in the haystack, to use a cliche. And part of that right now in the current threat environment speaks to the efficacy of the Islamic State's online recruitment cum incitement program, which is far more aggressive and, I think the caseload shows, effective than anything that al-Qaeda has pulled off and really even attempted for that matter. And the irony in all of that, I think that's important for your listeners to understand, is that they are converting social media platforms like Twitter into what amount to cyber sanctuaries from which they are engaging with people here in the United States and encouraging affirmation of allegiance to the Islamic State with the execution of terrorist attacks like this, what we've seen in Orlando.
Well, and interestingly, you've talked about how it's quite ineffective, actually, to shut down those social media accounts, that action almost becomes a badge of honor for the terrorists.
Yeah. The Wall Street Journal highlighted in a recent report that covered some of my work tracking the Islamic State's global influence operation online that the Islamic State support base on Twitter and other social media, they tout as credentials the number of times that their accounts have been closed. So what we need to start examining is a more robust approach to deterring that type of activity. They are essentially highlighting that the suspension campaign at Twitter is ineffective as policy goes. It's an insufficient deterrent. There are some protocols that could be implemented to discourage or deter the conversion of Twitter and Facebook and other social media into these international broadcast stations and forums for recruitment and incitement. Those would entail things like implementing such a policy as you can't access these platforms when you have a virtual private network active through which you're accessing the platform to mask your location. And the Islamic State has very much emphasized the use of VPNs or virtual private networks among their support base online so that they don't end up with people being arrested before they can actually go out and do something to act to affirm their support for the group.
A lot of listeners. Let's get some in here. Margaret in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, Margaret. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I have two observations with regard to the term lone wolf.
Okay.
President Obama uses the less inflammatory term lone actor, which is accurate, yet wouldn't seem to glorify a mentally imbalanced person. Also, when used to reference a Muslim, I think the term lone wolf echoes the use of the ethnic profiling term super predator used to refer to African Americans. So, you know, those are just two thoughts I wanted to throw out there.
Good, Margaret. Thank you. Let's ask Peter Bergen about that. What do you say, Peter?
Well, lone wolf is a term of art that's been around for a long time. I mean, the classic lone wolf was Ted Kaczynski, who many of you listening to this may recall. Ted Kaczynski, for about 20 years, sent a series of bombs to various people that he didn't, whose views he didn't like. He was sort of a neo-Luddite. He lived in a shack in Montana by himself with no internet, no electricity, and no connections to the outside world. He had no connections to a foreign terrorist organization or a domestic one, and that's the classic lone wolf. What's interesting now is what we term lone wolves are in fact operating in what the Israeli counterterrorism academic Gabriel Wyman has cleverly said, a virtual pack. Because somebody like Omar Mateen, we still don't know exactly what he was imbibing a lot of jihadist propaganda. But, you know, when you're online now and in the ISIS sort of ecosystem, I mean, you're thousands of people you're potentially also sharing your views, and you're in a virtual echo chamber of a lot of people who are from around the world who seem to agree with you. And so the whole conception of a lone wolf, I think, needs to be reconsidered slightly. But it's still a useful term in the sense that Omar Mateen had no formal connections to a terrorist organization, and which is quite different from, say, the 9/11 hijackers who were trained, financed by Al-Qaeda, or the attackers in Paris in November who were trained, financed by ISIS.
Margaret, thanks so much for the call. Let me play this sound. Here's FBI Director James Comey in a Washington press conference on Monday, saying that the Orlando shooter pledged loyalty to different and opposing extremist groups at different times during the shooting. Comey said that that added confusion about his motives.
He said he was doing this for the leader of ISIL, who he named and pledged loyalty to. But he also appeared to claim solidarity with the perpetrators of the Boston Marathon bombing and solidarity with a Florida man who died as a suicide bomber in Syria for Al-Nusra Front, a group in conflict with the so-called Islamic State.
Mike Smith, Comey also said that in comments to a coworker in 2013, the killer claimed to be a member of Hezbollah, which is a Shiite militia-based group. And, you know, these groups that he's been talking about and pledging allegiance to clearly have competing ideologies, which goes to the point of the investigation. You know, the FBI thought this guy must be all talk if he doesn't really know what he's talking about.
Sure. Well, I think that this person had a history of trying to put out indicators that he aspired to participate in terroristic activities such as what he has done in Orlando. I'm not sure what this individual's IQ level was, but it would seem it's conceivable that this person wanted to generate what amounts to, at least the perception as such, an intelligence failure of sorts. I'll set aside the reference to Hezbollah other than to say that obviously that's a recognizable name, a brand in international terrorism. And so by referencing Hezbollah, obviously there's a problem there in that we're talking about a Shia terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. And apparently this is somebody who was much more expressive of affinity, meanwhile, for actors in the global jihad movement, Salafi jihadist groups, Sunni spectrum terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda. I think that also back to the discussion about, you know, lone wolf, the use of the term itself really can undermine the public's comprehension of the threat environment. The way that this individual went about attributing his terrorist attack to one of the two dominant forces within the Salafi jihadist global jihad movement right now, you know, that's a connection with a larger movement. And as Peter was discussing, you know, the Unabomber, frankly, is the only example of what you can really call a lone wolf. That was somebody who developed his own ideology used to inform and legitimize a resort to violence. In the case of Mateen, you're talking about somebody who was essentially in one way or another adopting what is called Salafiyya Jihadiyya, which is the ideology which informs the agendas of the Islamic State as well as Al-Qaeda. And, you know, right now, yes, there is a competition for dominance within the movement between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And this individual clearly was expressing affirmation of support with his attack for the Islamic State. But at the same time, I mean, that doesn't discount that this individual wanted to highlight that really this act was part of a lot of activity that's occurring right now in association with the larger global jihad movement. And so, you know, the use of the term lone wolf is problematic in that it obscures that picture for the public, in that this is something that's linked to activity which is being encouraged quite rigorously online right now by a variety of elements that comprise the global jihad movement.
Mm. Let's go to Tom in Woburn, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane.
Hello.
I would like to talk about what I think your guests are missing is the forest for the trees. Now, one of your guests just mentioned that it's very disconcerting that there are so many of these jihadist movements that have contradictory agendas.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm saying is there is one agenda, okay? And there's one agenda that you don't need a mentor group like Al-Qaeda or ISIS to visit. All you have to do is have a copy of the Quran. There are over 400 verses in the Quran, on hating infidels and over 100 verses on killing said hated infidels. When you look at the Quran itself, it is sort of designed to spread one religion. If you look at verses 9:123 or 9:5
You're saying that there's a religious mandate here, Tom. I hear what you're saying. Mike Smith, would you respond based on your previous comments?
Well, it's been said by even a leading scholar in the field of what is now called countering violent extremism, Quentin Wiktorowicz, who has been an advisor to the Obama administration on the topic of countering violent extremism, that much of what you see in the way of the fundaments of, again, that ideology called Salafiyya Jihadiyya, they're not exactly what you can call theological outliers in terms of how these elements go about legitimizing and encouraging a resort to violence. Frankly, the Salafi jihadist trend is typically referred to as a militant outgrowth of Salafism, which is the dominant force in how Muslims in the Sunni spectrum really comprehend their faith in most places in the world. So what you typically do see are groups like the Islamic State wrapping their narratives in what you call truisms from the Salafi doctrine, because essentially that can serve to make it very difficult for what you might call moderate Muslims to argue against much of their logic. The big difference would be that Salafis do not go so far as to make it part of creed, this notion that one must resort to violence to effectuate the political reforms in an effort, a larger effort, to restore a caliphal model of governance, which is where all of this goes. I mean, the goal stated in al-Qaeda's founding documents is restoration of the caliphate. That's pretty much the only tangible goal expressed by al-Qaeda in 1988 when the organization was created. And now what you are seeing is an expression of that differently by the al-Qaeda offshoot, the Islamic State, which is claiming to have achieved that goal and is appealing to the aspirations of a very large audience of people who also similarly share that goal, and using that claim in a way to perhaps even accelerate the radicalization process that culminates in these resorts to violence that we see in the case of Mateen.
Let me get a call in here before the break. Jose in Marietta, Georgia, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. The FBI likes to tout their success in uncovering terrorist plots and foiling attacks, you know, and they have these prosecutions, you know, through the years. But Americans don't realize that the majority of these successes were stings bordering on entrapment of gullible, sympathetic Middle Eastern types, where they find some guy and they start communicating and they pretend to be Arabic themselves and similar sympathies and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they develop a case based on that kind of activity that the FBI initiates. Well, why did they had this guy already in their sights, twice interviewed, and they knew who he was, and yet they didn't do that. They didn't follow the usual procedure.
We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. Jose, thank you very much for the call. We're discussing the attack in Orlando and how the threat of terrorism is changing. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about soft targets, attacks by lone actors, and terrorism now. And you can join the conversation. What's the way forward? What's your question for these global counterterrorism experts? Peter Bergen is with me this hour from Washington. He's vice president at New America and author of United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Also, Mike Smith is with us from Charleston, South Carolina. He's co-founder of the security firm Kronos Advisory and counterterrorism advisor to members of Congress. To Jose's point before the break, Peter Bergen, what do you make of the fact that a man who was repeatedly investigated by the FBI was able to go out, buy an AK-15 rifle and a 9mm pistol to carry out that massacre in Orlando? What does that tell you about the effectiveness of the FBI and its watch lists?
Well, it's not in fact, it's very common for people who carry out lethal acts of terrorism in this country to have been on the radar of law enforcement. Major Nadar Hassan, who killed 13 at Fort Hood, was quite well known to the FBI field office in San Diego because he was sending multiple emails to an American cleric associated with Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Carlos Bledsoe, who killed an American soldier in Little Rock, Arkansas in 2009, was interviewed by the FBI both in the United States and in Yemen, where he went for and got further radicalized. Tamil Insaniyev was interviewed by the FBI in Boston because the Russians tipped off U.S. intelligence that he might be associated with Russian militant groups. And a year later, he killed three people attending the Boston Marathon with his bombs. And and also we live in a rule of law society. So you cannot keep investigations open just if there's no, what the FBI terms, derogatory information. And in the case of Omar Mateen, there didn't appear to be sufficient derogatory information. And having bad opinions and loathsome views in this country is protected by the First Amendment. And so the fact that he was saying that he was a member of Hezbollah, which obviously he wasn't, that's not sufficient. What the FBI is looking for is people who are along what they term the pathway to violence, which follows a very specific kind of set of procedures that any predatory killer follows, you know, casing targets, assembling weapons, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there'll be congressional investigations. In fact, I was talking to Chairman Mike McCaul of the House Homeland Security Committee, and just as they investigated what happened in Boston, they will investigate this, and I'm sure the FBI may, you know, look at its own procedures. But according to FBI Director Comey in his recent press conference, the procedures they had in place didn't allow this investigation just to carry on indefinitely. Mm.
Let's get Mark in here from Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to comment that, you know, it apparently, it's very clearly that the FBI have done a really bad job here because, you know, just like those previous shooters, you know, they had a lot of trails of the red signs, you know, like the person was radicalized, you know, this particular guy, you know, he was from the family of the Taliban supporters. And he was more than once expressed very, very offensive and very derogatory statements to his coworkers, and, you know, he was a friend with a suicide bomber and everything. And yet, you know, FBI not only let him go, but also allowed him to purchase the weapons. And, you know, there are things, you know, responsibilities. For example, only 2 months before the shooting, there was this imam invited to the same Orlando, you know, mosque where he was going, openly saying in English that, you know, gay people should be murdered. And again, nobody was brought to justice?
And
why
yet, to Peter Bergen's point, there's a rule of law in this country, and, you know, if they didn't have enough to take him and hold him, they didn't have enough. Kevin in Washington, D.C., you're on the line. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I have two quick points. The first is the proper term is not lone wolf. It's homegrown violent extremist, someone who is not in direct contact with someone like a terrorist overseas but is radicalized online or through their local neighborhood or, you know, place of worship. So that's the proper term for it. But secondly, as you know, as the guest just said, there's a First Amendment rights here. There are rules of law. There, you know, an individual just calling and saying my neighbor is a terrorist, it doesn't rise to probable cause to get a warrant to listen to their phones or to read their email. And so it's the responsibility of the people at your church, your community, your mosque, your school, your coworkers, and your family to say this person is a problem and we need to help law enforcement. So really, you know, everyone believes that, you know, the FBI and NSA are listening to all your phone calls, and it's just not true. They have to abide, and they do abide by the Constitution.
Kevin, thank you very much. I want to play some sound here. As we know, the Orlando massacre has made its way to the campaign trail. This is a speech from Monday. A GOP presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump said that American immigration policy is to blame for the attack at the Orlando nightclub.
The only reason the killer was in America in the first place was because we allowed his family to come here. That is a fact, and it's a fact we need to talk about. We have a dysfunctional immigration system which does not permit us to know who we let into our country, and it does not permit us to protect our citizens properly.
And speaking with NPR on Monday, presumptive Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton outlined the changes that she would make to prevent attacks by self-radicalized people.
I would set up a team exclusively dedicated to detecting and preventing lone wolf attacks. And that means providing more resources, creating more integrated intelligence use among all levels of law enforcement, strengthening the communication that we have coming from abroad as well as internally, and working with Silicon Valley to prevent online radicalization.
So, Peter Bergen, there we hear Donald Trump talking about a dysfunctional immigration system. Many people agree. Hillary Clinton saying, you know, we've got to create a more integrated intelligence community, strengthen communications we have with people abroad, use Silicon Valley, bring in all of these different resources. What do you hear in that? What would work moving us forward?
Well, what wouldn't work is banning Muslim immigration. I mean, Mateen, who carried out the Orlando attack, his family came 30 years ago. Donald Trump claims to do many things. I don't think he can reverse time and go back 30 years and prevent an Afghan family fleeing the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan when Ronald Reagan was president from coming into this country. And it's a completely ludicrous idea. After all, every lethal terrorist attack's been carried out by Americans and or American legal permanent residents. So let's set aside the immigration thing. It's a red herring. What can we do better? We are not doing a bad job. I mean, if we'd had this conversation in 2002 and I said, you know, in the next 15 years, we would see on average six Americans killed every year by jihadi terrorists, that would have seemed like an absurdly optimistic claim because we were worried about a second wave of al-Qaeda attacks and the like. But the fact is that we've managed the problem pretty well. Foreign terrorist organizations have not carried out any attacks in the United States since 9/11. And what we're left with is this domestic problem. And, you know, as the president said in his remarks, that is pretty hard to deal with sometimes. Now, the FBI has got 900 investigations in all 50 states. But by the law of averages, somebody is going to get one through because you can't survey absolutely everyone who has bad or radical ideas, both on First Amendment grounds and also because you just don't have that many people to survey all the people who have bad ideas in this country.
So Michael Smith, Peter Bergen says, you know, the FBI is not doing a bad job, and yet there are many people who want answers. Why did 49 people die? Why did this guy get through the system? What do you say?
Well, right now we don't have enough information out there publicly anyway about Mateen and how this transpired. But what I would say is that Peter's absolutely correct. I mean, having been engaged with people at FBI Washington field office frequently and elsewhere in the country, I mean, the FBI has done a truly remarkable job about keeping their finger on the pulse of potential threats and interdicting, especially individuals who are demonstrating an affinity for the Islamic State. And perhaps even a willingness to act to affirm their support in the ways that have been prescribed by its leadership. But what I do think is important to consider is that it's not just about the FBI in terms of, well, the protocol is we only have 3 months, for example, or whatever that protocol may be for a window in which you can assess a threat to public safety posed by a suspected sympathizer of a foreign terrorist organization. The FBI should be engaging with local law enforcement, and this came out in congressional hearings following the Boston Marathon attack, that, you know, the police commissioner from Boston affirmed that had he been apprised of the reporting from Russian foreign intelligence about one of the Tsarnaev brothers, that he would have certainly allocated more soft resources to continuing the assessment of a potential threat posed by that individual, recognizing that FBI can only investigate somebody for a specific period of time, at which point the case is either, you know, continued or it's closed because of a lack of evidence for a need to continue the investigation. So really, there needs to be a closer coordination with local law enforcement personnel who have greater latitude to apply certain resources for the purposes of continuing the process of determining, is there indeed a threat here? Working with family members, working with neighbors, just engaging with individuals directly on an ongoing basis to ascertain whether or not they intend to demonstrate their affinities for these groups like al-Qaeda or the Islamic State with an act of terrorism, just as the one that just occurred in Orlando.
Here's U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson yesterday on CNN talking about how to deal with the threat of a lone actor, a terrorist act in the United States.
When you're dealing with homegrown violent extremists, the so-called lone wolf or lone actor, almost always somebody close to that person saw the signs. Somebody close to that person was aware of a gun purchase, saw suspicious behavior, which is why our efforts to build bridges to various communities around this country are so important. Why, if you see something, say something, is more than a slogan.
Building various communities around this country is so important. Here's Irfan in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program. Hello. Irfan?
My comment is, in all of this conversation we're talking about, the biggest solution we have on the table at this stage, everything is speculation, is actually American Muslim communities. We need their support. We need their trust. So they could actually call in the appropriate response agency, because at the end of the day, all American Muslim community is hearing is demagogy and finger-pointing at this stage. You cannot possibly monitor 2,106 mosques in the whole United States and 6 million people.
Irfan, thank you. Well, that's essentially what Jay Johnson was saying, Peter Bergen, building bridges to various communities, the American Muslim community being one of them.
The FBI has looked at 80 cases, terrorism cases, since in the last several years, and they found very interesting findings. The people who know the most about a potential plot are peers. The people who know the next amount are family members, and then authority figures know slightly less, say clerics or teachers. And finally, the people who know the least are strangers. But the paradoxical, of course, strangers are the most likely to call the police, so you get a lot of false positives. And the people who are least likely to inform law enforcement are peers. They found all this because of their initial interest in school shootings. And so the fact that the wife was aware, generally speaking, that this guy was planning a jihadi terrorist attack is not surprising at all. Mm. And so the caller is completely correct that what we want to do is not necessarily encourage lots of strangers to sort of say, I saw a strange-looking Arab man photographing a bridge, because that's usually 99% of the time, that's just somebody taking a photograph of the bridge. What we want to do is encourage the Muslim community, who, by the way, are doing quite a good job on this front. According to a New America research, about a third of the cases that have been instigated in this country since 9/11, terrorism cases, have been instigated by a family member or a community member. Mm. But the fact is that we wouldn't be having this conversation at all if the wife perhaps had informed authorities. Of course, that's very difficult for a wife to, you know, essentially shop her own husband. I mean, there's a reason we don't have spouses testify against each other in trials. But the fact is, the really useful information is going to come from peers and family members who are most likely to see signs of radicalization and actions along the path to actually committing an act of violence.
Let's get Mark in here from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Mark. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, fine. Go ahead.
Actually, real quick, because I know you're running out of time, I just wanted to throw a perspective out there. I was in Iraq a couple times, was wounded while I was over there. The honor that I had was I was assigned to a specialized team twice that I worked with and was embedded with the Iraqi army while I was over there. And the thing that I learned very quickly is there are bad people out there, but there are also good people. And the thing that bothers me the most is that everybody wants to put an act like this into a happy little box and, you know, label it as something. But the reality of it is, it's on the individual. It's not on the community. It's not on the religion. And it kills me as both a soldier and a human being to see us as the U.S. act like this sometimes.
Mark, excellent point taken. I really appreciate your call. Just wrapping up here, Peter Bergen, I'm going to give you the last word. You've been doing this for a really long time. You produced the first television interview with Osama bin Laden back in 1997, the first time he declared war against the U.S. to a Western audience. How do you see this? What is this? What's your sense of the terrorist threat now moving forward versus what we actually think the fear it to be? You know, what is it versus the fear?
Well, it's a low-level persistent threat in the United States. It's very much lower than it is in Europe, where it's higher. And then, of course, in the Middle East, it's, you know, off the charts, and that's unlikely to change because you have three very big trends coming down the pike: a regional civil war between the Shia and the Sunni, the collapse of so many Arab governments, and then you add to that your massive immigration into Europe and the rise of European fascism, which is a very toxic brew in Europe. So, you know, we're going to see low-level lone wolf militants in this country carrying out these kinds of attacks. Occasionally they're going to get one through. You know, you could see a Paris-style attack happening in Europe where 130 people were killed fairly regularly. And the Middle East, you know, we're not, you know, I thought the death of bin Laden and the rise of the Arab Spring would sort of mean these kinds of conversations were less likely to happen. Unfortunately, we're seeing the arrival of the Arab winter, and this is going to be with us for some period of time.
Peter Bergen, Vice President at New America, a national security analyst at CNN, and author of The United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Peter Bergen, always nice to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Mike Smith, co-founder of the security firm Kronos Advisory and counterterrorism advisor to members of Congress. Members, Mike, great to have your perspective today. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can continue the conversation. Listeners, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow after Orlando, a new push to ban semi-automatic assault weapons. We'll have that debate. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.